tough to give a speech today. You know, the macro geopolitical backdrop being as calm and quiet as it is, there's not much to pick from. Actually, what I'd like to do is connect some dots in terms of Keynes and Minsky, and in terms of mainstream macro theory, and weave that into how we might have ended up with Trump as president, and with some of the insanities that we've seen so far. So if we reach back and think back about Keynes and Minsky, I would argue that what we have is a convention from Keynes and an observation about conviction levels from Minsky. And I'm going to speak about that and follow that through over the last 10 years and show you that it still very much holds up. I'm also going to drag Saudi Arabia in because although it's somewhat tangential, I think it's quite interesting if you think about what they're doing right now and you think about it within the context of how we make forecasts and can influence markets. And then I'm going to wax a little bit philosophic, and I apologize for this, but hell, I turned 65 last week. I'm on Medicare. I can do whatever the hell I want. And so I'm going to reach back to Kierkegaard and Socrates and get into some philosophical constructs that lead us to some notions about what we don't know, how we might have gotten into trouble pretending we did know, but that how now we're in a situation where we may not know, but we surely know what's not going to happen, and most of it's described via tweets. Okay, so Keynes, what does Keynes say to us? He says, only a little bit more than a trip to the South Pole are our enterprises driven by mathematical calculations of benefits to come, right? And Minsky's phrase attached to that was pervasive uncertainty, Knightian uncertainty. And Keynes suggests in the most omitted chapter of any mainstream economist reading, chapter 12, of the general theory. He says, and so the way we get through our day and comport ourselves sensibly, we think, is to embrace a convention. And what's the convention in my version of Keynes? What's the convention that we use for forecasting, right? I mean, we're long-term investors. That means we care about 20 years from now. Well, if we're honest, we haven't a clue what's going to happen 20 years from now. I would submit right now 20 months from now is a really dangerous forecast. But 20 years from now? So what do we do? What's the Keynesian convention? We assume that tomorrow will be yesterday. Okay, and as long as we believe that tomorrow will be yesterday, then we're really just in the business of looking really carefully into the rearview mirror, and it's the rearview mirror that drives our evolving sense of where we're going. Where we're going is where we just have been. And having been on Wall Street for 30 years, I can tell you, think about the markets and how they respond to different kinds of news. You'll almost never see the following headline. The market fell by 10% when news that Goldman Sachs changed their forecast came out. People don't respond to forecasts. You will see a headline that says, the market, the bond market rallied furiously and interest rates fell by 30 basis points when the jobs report came out and it was 30,000 instead of 230,000. So the recent past can drive nearly instantly our opinion of the future rather than any pretense that somebody has a crystal ball beyond that. All right, so Keynes says tomorrow is yesterday. What did Minsky add? What did Minsky add that was so powerful? What he added was, and our conviction level that tomorrow is yesterday is a function of how many yesterdays in a row we string together that look the same. Okay? Now, that shouldn't be the way it is. In the book I wrote trying to invoke High Minsky, I said in Never Never Land of rational forward-looking investors, 8 years into an expansion, you might say, well, geez, I don't know what's gonna happen. But I know there's been a recession every 5 to 11 years in any one of 70 countries around the world over the last 100 years. So I'm going to make somebody pay me a little bit more for risk right now because this thing looks long in the tooth. Instead, if you look at risk spreads, if you look at VIX, if you look at BAA versus 10-year yields, exactly the opposite is true. The longer the expansion endures, the more relaxed we seem to get. And when we get more relaxed, and this is Hy's financial instability hypothesis, as we get more relaxed, we put on more risky finance. So the financial architecture gets less and less stable the longer the expansion endures, because we more and more believe that tomorrow will in fact look like yesterday. Okay, so let's test this hypothesis. Let's imagine that you have an island economy, all right? It's an island, it's an economy, it's big relative to most around the world, maybe fourth or fifth large. And that island economy suffers a tsunami, and one of their nuclear power plants gets blithered up, and there's radioactive waste within 20 miles. Okay, now, what kind of tail risk should we put on U.S. financial assets? Now, what is that likely to do to somebody bending metal in Des Moines or growing wheat in Kansas? Okay, alternatively, we have a real rogue nation with a crazy leader who starts firing ICBMs every 30 days. And we have a newly elected, incredibly ignorant of history, president who's in charge of the biggest nuclear arsenal in the world, and they get into a confrontation. How much risk should we assign associated with tail events to that? Now, I can't figure out an honest answer for A versus B, but I sure know which one I would think is bigger. Right? What the hell could happen if a nuclear power plant in Japan has a radioactive leak? What's going to happen in Kansas? Nothing. What might transpire if we're in a confrontation right now with North Korea? I don't know, but I have to admit that the tail risks there are infinitely larger. Okay. However, when did we have the tsunami in Japan? In 2011. 2011 was only 2 years after the biggest recession since the Great Depression. It was only 2 years after the stock market had fallen by 70%. And the financial market reaction to that event showed a big increase in risk, big increase in fear, right? Treasury bonds soared, the VIX went from 15 to 35, BAA 10-year spreads went out dramatically, stocks fell by about 7.5%. In the current situation, we've had next to nothing in terms of reaction. Now again, I'm not suggesting I know what the reaction should be on an absolute basis, but on a relative basis, the tail risk associated with this geopolitical event today has to be deemed to be much larger than the nuclear accident in Japan. But this is 8 years into an expansion, and so we're blithely smiling. Okay. Now, do we get into trouble? Obviously, we do when we use this kind of forecasting method, but it's the best we've got, we think. My favorite example of tomorrow will be yesterday and conviction level growing as we string a number of yesterdays together. So CBO in 96, 97, 98, 99, they kept saying, well, we don't understand. We don't know where these revenues are coming from, but they keep coming in 20% higher than we thought. And so for 4 years, they said, it'll go back, it'll mean revert. We'll get personal income tax receipts that make sense relative to where the economy appears to be. By 2000, it was 5 years. Five times four, that's 20 quarters. If you're in the forecasting business and you've been wrong for 20 quarters, you're beaten up beyond belief. So what did CBO do in 2000? They waved the white flag and they said, oh, this must be permanent. It must be permanent, and therefore we're going to keep these tax revenues as a share of personal income, which were 20% higher than made sense. Moreover, since we haven't had a recession now in 11 years, well, we won't have a recession. Since we've had productivity at 2.8% for 6 years, we'll keep it at 2.6%. We won't have any bear markets. We haven't had one in 11 years. And we won't have any wars. And so CBO in 2000 forecast that over the next 10 years, we would have a $5 trillion surplus. Okay, now as it turns out, as we know, you had two wars, two recessions, big bear market, and you mean reverted on income, taxes from income, plus productivity went from 2.7 to 0.7, and we ended up with $20 trillion in debt instead of $5 trillion surplus. Okay. That's a big miss, I would submit, but you can see how you get there if the persistence of a trend stays in place. I want to segue for a moment to Saudi Arabia. So what we're saying is the current state of affairs informs your opinion about the future. I can't tell you the fights I have with my academic brethren at Johns Hopkins when I insist on this. Run a chart of the market capitalization of large oil companies and the current, that is, today's oil price. And what you discover is today's oil price explains about 80% of the ups and downs of the market capitalization of these companies. Now, what could that possibly mean? I mean, that's crazy, right? What it means is, well, I know that they've got this big bag of oil in the ground, and I have to figure out how much it's worth, and I have price times quantity, okay, and I use a discount rate. The other 20% is where our interest rates in terms of that market capitalization. And so if oil prices are $60, it's worth twice as much as if oil prices are $30, and I can't do better than the market in guessing where oil prices will be. So now let's suppose some of us think we can do better than that. Let's suppose that we're Saudi Arabia and we hired 30 people, 10 from MIT, 10 from Harvard, 10 from Johns Hopkins, okay? All right, oh no, 5 from the Minsky Institute, 5 from Johns Hopkins. All right, and we've got this collection of people, and they're in the business of trying to figure out what's going to happen to oil prices. And they sit down and say, well, notwithstanding the rantings of Donald Trump, the fact is time and tide and technology wait for no man. And if you look at what's going on right now with technology, in 30 years' time, oil is going to be a lot less important. And it looks like the price over the long term is going down, not up. Now, if we had 10,000 acres, or excuse me, 10,000 barrels in Pennsylvania, we sell it tomorrow. If you have 287 billion barrels, as Saudi Arabia does, how the hell do you sell it tomorrow? How do you sell it tomorrow? What do? An IPO. You do an initial public offering. You say, I'm going to let you have a piece of this oil. Okay, you're going to have a chunk. Now, but how do we value that oil in the ground? What's the driving force in the value of the oil in the ground? The price. So what might you do in the 6 months leading up to the IPO? Let me see now. Maybe we could cut production and make the price go to $60 and hold it there while we give you all 10% of the firm. Okay, now people will say, well, but if you cut production, you're going to re-enfranchise the frackers and they'll be back in place. And they say, we don't care. We're re-enfranchising them for 6 months. Okay, anyway, if you have an insight that's what informs those decisions, you can get to that place. Okay. So now, philosophical musings. Okay, so Kierkegaard wrote a book called The Concept of Irony. I have it by my bedside. I've had it since I was a junior in college. I never get past like page 10, but it's if you need to sleep, read The Concept of Irony by Kierkegaard. But in there, he basically says that, okay, the elemental notion of irony is a product of Socrates. And Socrates told us, well, I don't know. But the one thing I do know is you don't know. Okay, and they killed him for that. John Kenneth Galbraith basically modified that. In fact, I loved Galbraith's modification until I realized it was a modification. Then I thought, well, he's clever, but you know, he's a borrower like the rest of us. And what he said was, there are only two kinds of economists in the world, right? Those who know they don't know, and those who don't know they don't know. Now, I would submit that that insight was lost on mainstream macroeconomics. And I think you can lay some fair share of the blame for having the Donald Trump administration at the doorstep of mainstream economics. Because we, or they, pretended to much more of an understanding of how things work than we have. Okay, so there were two sins, right? The first sin was we pretended to know more than we really do, and we sat around talking about the great moderation and how we had tamed, was it Prescott who said, well, we've solved the depression thing and we now know how to steer the economy. I mean, you just, any sense of irony, and you never would have let those words out of your mouth if you were an economist. Obviously, Prescott has no sense of irony. So that was a first order sin, right? We drove the global economy off a cliff, promising everybody that we knew precisely what we were doing as we went off. Okay, everybody remember the book Lord Jim? He's in the Patna, and he says it's okay, I'll take care. And then he, at the last minute, he jumps in the safety boat and leaves the masses. So that's the first sin. But unlike Lord Jim, who takes it between the eyes at the end of the book, we have the Great Recession and there's no remorse, right? There's no contrition. We blame it on the Chicago School. I mean, the Chicago School blitheringly detached from the real economy, but not in charge. The Chicago School wasn't in charge. The new Keynesians were in charge. And so Krugman constantly writing about the Chicago, who are you kidding? You guys were in charge when we went off the cliff. So no contrition after driving us off the cliff. And a lot of people who don't know much of anything I just said, but know that the smarties drove us off a cliff, said, as we say in Italian, basta così, that's enough of that. And we're going to put one of our guys in charge. Okay, let's let stupid try. Okay, so where does that leave us? Because we overpromised, because we pretended to know more than we really do, we're now in a situation where you can assert almost anything you want to. Right, so think back to the moral relativists. Remember the brain in a jar thing? Right? It's the movie The Matrix. Okay, you think you're in a world, actually you're just getting electronic transmissions that describe a world to you. And the philosophers like to point out, if you are in the movie The Matrix and you're in one of those pods and you're just generating heat for the batteries, there's no logic you can use to figure out that you're not in a jar. Right? Now, that's a fun philosophical notion, but I think we don't have to be that nihilistic, and that's where the sad part of all of this comes about. Had we not overpromised, we could say the following, something a la Socrates, which is, I don't know what's going to happen. I know you don't know what's going to happen, but I also know, even though I don't know what's going to happen, I know what you're saying is going to happen can't possibly happen. So even though I don't know what the truth is about the future, I have value because I can tell you that the following seven things you said you were going to do are nonsense, categorical nonsense. Now, I'm 65. I do take this personally because a lot of us, we work really hard at this stuff. It really is hard. And you're just trying to say, well, I don't know what's going to happen, but you're not going to create 25 million jobs over the next 10 years. Okay? You're just not. Right? And we could do the arithmetic on that. 25 million jobs over the next 10 years is 200,000 a month. Okay? If we allow the prime age participation rate to go back to its all-time peak, and we allow the unemployment rate to go to 3%, I think those are pretty aggressive, right? So I'm not talking about Nehru and we've got to stop right now. Thank you, Esther George. All right, I'm way beyond that. I'm allowing it to rip for 3 years. Right, let it rip for 3 years. At the end of the 3 years, you've now exhausted all the excess you have, and now you are captive to demographics. So what are the demographics? Well, the latest survey we have from the Census Department, and it was produced before Trump was elected, said that the population, the working age population will grow, okay, before we talk about age cohorts, before we talk about the aging baby boomers, it's gonna grow at 0.5% a year. Why is it gonna grow at 0.5% a year? Well, there's two sources for growth, right? Births minus deaths and net immigration. What percent of that growth that they forecast is net immigration? 50. So now we've only got 0.5% growth, which is roughly speaking 100,000 a month. But if Trump succeeds and we get those net immigration numbers down, now we're at something on the order of 60 or 70,000 a month. So 25 million is not only not in the realm of the likely, I would submit it's mathematically impossible. Although, someone did point out to me that Betty DeVos, who did support a group that's written on why we should allow child labor, if we allow 6 to 16 year olds to work instead of go to school, they actually do have a shot. Okay, so similarly, we have Peter Navarro. Now, Peter Navarro takes my breath away, I've got to tell you. Peter Navarro, he says we need bilateral confrontations. Right? Mano a mano, which he thinks means man to man. Okay? All right. So we need bilateral confrontations. And because I know Trump is a great negotiator, we're going to get the trade deficit to go 4%, 3%, 2%, 1%, 0. All right? So it's going to disappear in 4 years. And that means I get to add a percentage point to growth each year. That's why GDP can be 4 instead of 3. Okay, let's look at that historically and then deep historically. So obviously, Keynes would think that that was nonsensical. It turns out that so would Adam Smith, right? So let's reach all the way back to a mercantilist, right? 1664, Thomas Mann. Thomas Mann, who Adam Smith labeled the Bible man of mercantilism. So he's Mr. Mercantilism. He argues in his book that you never want to think bilaterally. And he looks at the Eastern Trade Association and the fact that they ran this big trade deficit with Asia, right? They gave much more gold to Asia than they got stuff, but they overwhelmed that in terms of all the gold they got selling the stuff they got from Asia in continental Europe. And so even Thomas Mann in 1664 knew that you didn't look bilaterally. Okay. Now, what about shaping it closer to home? We can look at the income elasticity of demand for imports. We can say what happens when the U.S. accelerates. It turns out that when the U.S. accelerates, we demand cyclically sensitive stuff, and mostly that's imported. So the income elasticity of demand for imports says that if you can get the economy to accelerate, you're going to have imports grow twice as fast, right? So your trade deficit goes up. In addition, what happens when the U.S. economy does much better than the rest of the world to the dollar? It goes up. So now we've got a price elasticity of demand problem. So to forecast the trade deficit going from 4 to 0 in an environment where you're stepping on the gas, the rest of the world is still with their foot on the brake, and you're going to do it based on bilateral negotiations is breathtaking. Okay. Now, a more reasonable notion, of course, is healthcare, where everyone's covered, it's much better, and we have lower premiums. There's nothing I can add to that. Actually, there is one thing I can add. The Heritage Foundation wrote a paper, and this is the Heritage Foundation, right? Not the Brookings Institute, not the Minsky Group. This is the Heritage Foundation. The Heritage Foundation wrote a 4-page essay, and they gave it to Ronald Reagan in 1983. And it said, look, the kid's 28. He's decided who the hell needs health care insurance. He has a car accident. The ambulance takes him to the hospital. They find out he doesn't have insurance. It's going to cost $83,000 or he's dead. If you spend the $83,000, he lives a very happy life. What do? If it's free market, baby, you put him in the driveway and you let him die. If you spend the 83 grand, it's socialized medicine. And so the Heritage Foundation in 83 said, you can't end run this because nobody's going to leave him. Nobody's going to leave him in the driveway. And of course, now what we have is an enormous number of people who use the emergency room and rip up the bill. Okay. Lastly, in terms of examples, we have Mick Mulvaney, who I think the reason that Trump selected him to be the head of OMB is because Mulvaney is on record a number of times saying he didn't think it was such a bad idea to default on the debt. And this is something that Trump knows a lot about. Mr. Mulvaney promises us that he's going to balance the budget in the next 10 years. He's going to balance the budget in the next 10 years in an environment where you're trying, on the Republican side, you're trying to put into place a really large tax cut. That's a neat trick. Now, the problem for, I think, Donald Trump, he wants desperately to be, boom, wants to be Ronald Reagan. Well, he wants to be liked, that's for sure. Daddy didn't like him, but he wants to be Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan had some deep personality traits that fared him well. He was affable, right? People said, you know, I like him. I've never heard anybody say that about Donald Trump. It really helps if you're a politician to have people like you. Okay. In addition, he gave 100 speeches that said, I'm going to slash taxes, I'm going to radically increase defense spending, the economy is going to boom, and because of that, the budget deficit is going to go to zero. And what did he do? He slashed taxes, radically increased defense spending, the economy boomed, and the budget deficit soared. But he just gave a speech 4 years later and said, I told you I was going to slash taxes, and I told you I was going to increase defense spending, and I told you the economy was going to boom. QED. Okay? Donald Trump's in a perfect position to have done that. Right? All he had to do was pretend that the supply side miracle would work, ignore the fact that deficits would go up a lot, slash taxes, big infrastructure program, and he had a shot at performing that same. Now, I'm not endorsing that. I'm saying that was a strategy that could work. This is, I guess, simply not a strategy. And again, to come back to where I began, I think economists played a role in this by pretending we know more than we do. You know, a Heye's two-liner, if there's two words that exemplify Heye's whole career, it's pervasive uncertainty. How do you run around with that level of certitude if you can appreciate that? And it's gotten us to the point where people have made judgments that because they figured out we don't know what's going to happen, they then conclude that we don't know anything more than anybody else. And I would submit that those two things are not the same. Okay? And I think that's a shame. And I'm going to open this up now for questions.